From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I think it is hard for anybody to deny that our campaign has the momentum. You are the momentum. Look around you tonight.
That was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders after sweeping Saturday's so-called Western Tuesday. Sanders added to his recent momentum against Democratic rival Hillary Clinton with a finish for the day, netting roughly 68 delegates over Clinton in three lopsided victories. His biggest margin was in Alaska, where he defeated Clinton 82% to 18%, and the biggest delegate boost came from Washington, which he won with a margin of 73% to 27%, outperforming then-Senator Barack Obama's 2008 results. Saturday's sweep of all three states followed a sweep of five of six contests held earlier in the week. Sanders has closed the delegate gap, with Clinton's lead now reduced to 228 at 1266 to 1038. 868 delegates are up for grabs in April. On the Republican side, Donald Trump gained in the all-important delegate count over rivals Ted Cruz and John Kasich in two contests where the votes were split between Trump, who grabbed Arizona, and Cruz, who won in Utah. Thus far, Trump has secured three-fifths of the delegates required to win. As Trump has soared in both his share of the Republican vote and his share of delegates, supporters of Democrat Hillary Clinton have joined supporters of besieged Republican Ted Cruz in branding the Republican frontrunner as a danger to the country and the world, with some calling for what they term a united front behind Clinton to stop him. But not everyone is buying into that. One such person is political commentator and Asian activist Danny Haifong, whose recent column at blackagendareport.com is entitled, "Why a United Front Against Trump is Dangerous Territory for the Left." We'll speak with him about that later in this newscast. Al Jazeera Broadcasting Network, based in Qatar, will lay off about 500 employees who make up more than 10% of the total workforce. The network announced the cuts Sunday, citing financial pressures facing the tiny Gulf state of Qatar, where it's based, due to low global prices for oil and natural gas. Most of the affected are based at the Doha headquarters, according to a statement from Al Jazeera, which is controlled by Qatar's royal family. Before the layoffs, the network employed about 4,000 staff, a spokesperson said. Al Jazeera recently closed Al Jazeera America. The U.S. National Security Agency's head, who also serves as commander of the U.S. Cyber Command, made a quiet visit to Israel in an apparent effort to strengthen ties with Israel's cyber spy agencies. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
According to Israeli media, Admiral Michael Rogers, who visited Israel last week, discussed cooperation against cyber attacks by Iran and Lebanon's Hezbollah. Tehran says it has never carried out any cyber attacks. The foreign ministry spokesman has rejected U.S. allegations that Tehran has been behind cyber attacks against several American institutions. Hossein Jabari Ansari said the U.S. has in the past carried out cyber attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities, endangering millions of lives. In 2010, the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran's nuclear facilities with a computer virus called Stuxnet.
Cuba's former president Fidel Castro issued a warning to the U.S., that it should forget any hopes they might harbor that the Caribbean nation would roll over and serve the interests of Washington. In an opinion piece he authored for Cuba Debate following last week's visit to the island by U.S. President Barack Obama, Castro wrote, quote, "Cuba doesn't need the empire to give us anything," closed quote, referring to the U.S. As Republican Donald Trump has soared in both his share of the Republican vote and his share of delegates, supporters of Democrat Hillary Clinton have been calling for a united front to stop him. But not everyone is buying into that, including political commentator and Asian activist Danny Haifong of Boston, whose recent column at blackagendareport.com is entitled, "Why a United Front Against Trump is Dangerous Territory for the Left." We spoke with him via Skype from Boston Sunday. Very interesting piece that you have this past week. One of the captions inside the story, the talking points of the two corporate parties become what Antonio Gramsci called common sense. Why don't we start there? And for our listeners first, it was defined by Gramsci. Common sense is the embedded, incoherent, spontaneous beliefs and assumptions that characterize the conformist thinking of the masses of people in a given social order. All people, not only specialized professional intellectuals, are philosophers. However, while their spontaneous philosophy contains an element of practical empirical knowledge, it's in the main composed of superstition, folklore, simple religious beliefs, and the deposits of previous philosophy. So we're talking here about essentially that popular mythology is what common sense really is, and it bears directly on the beliefs of people about electoral politics in the United States. So I think that that's a good thing to parse out. Let's start with that.
So, you know, Antonio Gramsci was actually murdered by fascism, by actual fascism, Italian fascism. Mm-hmm. You know, most of his work as an Italian Marxist focused on ideology and how the hegemony of capitalism produced and reproduced its own ideological machinations in order to reproduce the material conditions of the system of exploitation. And I think, you know, U.S. elections every 4 years ramps up and heightens, you know, the ideological justifications of U.S. imperialism all around the world, and, you know, both in its domestic and foreign policies. I think, you know, what I write about in my article is why United Front Against Trump is, you know, incorrect and a mistake for the left, because what it does is it reproduces a very popular mythology in the United States that, you know, there are two evils that we are supposedly choosing between, that one of those evils, the Democratic Party, is less evil than the Republican Party. And I think what this does is it justifies the more bourgeois liberal side and side of the bourgeoisie, which, I mean, by all accounts, is more dangerous than the Republican side. I think, you know, we saw this really in, you know, hindsight and in clear view during the last 8 years of the Obama administration, where, you know, when masses of people got angry and, you know, started protesting the Iraq war and started to really become frustrated with the, you know, with Washington's two-party corporate duopolies behavior when it came to Wall Street, its support and basically dictatorship that it ruled when it comes to Wall Street. I think, you know, the Obama administration came in and basically did everything that the prior administration did, and, you know, even more so when it came to certain policies, whether it was drone warfare, whether it was the bailouts, whether it was the heightened surveillance, and, of course, the wars abroad that the United States is heavily indebted and embedded in right now when it comes to Libya or Syria or, you know, Latin America. We could go all across the world. So I think what's important to realize and understand is that when Gramsci was talking about common sense, he was talking about the, you know, the ideological component of capitalism and imperialism and how that is reproduced in society to justify the, you know, the inherent exploitation, oppression, and destruction in the capitalist system. And there's nothing more, you know, there's nothing better to look at than the presidential electoral system in the United States when it comes to this framework that Gramsci was using.
Yeah, you know, just to provide some examples, we have, for example, the two the Republican and Democratic parties, the two major parties, as they're called, which is already weighted. But and I don't think they've said the words Jill and Stein in the same newscast at all in the last year and a half. Certainly they haven't had her on. And they also, I don't think they've ever said the word Moorhead
other than, you know, when they're maybe going to a commercial for Bewitched or something, and they're talking about Agnes. And the same with Gloria LaRiva, shut out, Rocky Anderson, shut out. All these people have nothing to say. Among those that we see all the time, Donald Trump, who's the subject of your article, or is, in any event, the focal point of your article, and also Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, we hear those names, Kasich not as much, but those names all the time. We see their faces all the time. We hear what they're saying all the time. You could fairly say that you have all of them a common foreign policy, with the exception of Trump, who we'll get to, but all of them an imperialist foreign policy. And so when they're doing a comparison, for example, that particularly people who tell me that they're on the left, that say, well, between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it's a no-brainer. Yes, Clinton is an imperialist. So is Trump. Trump's a racist. Clinton's not a racist. So obviously I vote for Clinton. That is like the choice that's being afforded. And likewise, you know, it's difficult to term the foreign policy, you know, utterings of Sanders, even, certainly of Kasich and Cruz, as anything but imperialist. So we are being offered no alternative to an imperialist foreign policy, and then various forms of racial or gender discrimination among Cruz, Trump, and Clinton, who, by the way, is no angel historically on that score either, particularly in terms of actual policy. So Trump has presented somewhat of a different take on foreign policy, and in some ways unique in the discussion among major party candidates, as they call them, going back to World War II, looking at the usefulness or whether or not basically NATO is obsolete. He says NATO is obsolete and points to the fact that it was created for the conditions that existed, or that in any event were alleged to exist at the end of World War II. It was created with the purpose of taking down the Soviet Union, and that was accomplished in 1991. Since then, it's more expensive. There's more military equipment, and it's pointing at Russia. And he's also said on some occasions, you know, who wants to have a world war with Russia? Are you crazy? No one else is saying that.
Right. Yeah. You know, this, I think, why I wrote my article the way I did, and I think it may receive some pushback among the left, of course, because it is specifically addressing the left and criticizing it in the United States, because I think what we have to understand as, you know, the principled left in this country is that this election cycle is a really interesting moment, an interesting time in general, because I think what the election cycle this year really represents and reflects is the crisis in the overall imperialist system. And when I say that, what I mean is that we can see the way that Sanders and Trump have really exposed the fissures, the disagreements, the divisions, but also almost the necessities that the imperialist system has to take into account when it is, you know, when it is coming out of the post-Obama stupor and having to, again, do what Antonio Gramsci says, reproduce the, you know, the ideological machinations of the imperialist system in order to thus reproduce the actual policy, the actual conditions that the system imposes on masses of people, and that is misery. So when we look at Trump's foreign policy, you can, it's obvious to see that while if he were to become president, of course, everything is off the table and we might as well get ready for a fight in a similar manner we would for a Democratic Party president, sure. But just his language and the way he's campaigning is very interesting, because we can see that Democratic Party imperialist policies have pushed the political situation in the United States so far to the right that in order to captivate Trump, in order to captivate the Republican Party base, Trump has basically veered to the left and veered to positions that really do appeal to, maybe they are racist, maybe they are very neoconservative in a certain type of way, isolationist, quote-unquote. And I think Eric Dreitzer writes a very good article about how Trump's foreign policy team is very pro-imperialist, and that should be obvious. But the positions he's taking on things like NATO, on things like military bases abroad, on issues of trade, all of those things appeal to an increasingly frustrated, increasingly dispossessed, poor voting base of the Republican Party. And that is very important because the material conditions in the United States are so disastrous that both of the, I guess you could say, less mainstream candidates within the two-party duopoly elections right now, Trump and Sanders, have both appealed to certain sections of the Democratic Party and Republican base that really reflect the growing frustration and the growing crisis in the United States and in the global world imperialist system as a whole. So that is really important because I think to specifically focus on Trump alone, to specifically focus on the dangers or the supposed fascism that his campaign would bring is a huge mistake because it falls right into, Gramsci's philosophy of common sense, where basically this lesser of two evils ideology will merely be reproduced in a new way. And the Democratic Party is already gearing up with Hillary Clinton to, basically, once the general elections roll around, strategize around this very idea that Trump is so dangerous to the future of the United States, so dangerous to, the conditions of the Democratic Party base, whether it's immigrants, Black Americans, or workers and unions in general, that she should be the one who, takes the mantle and becomes the president of the United States. But I think Tony Montero and your conversations have been spot on, on CPR, because Hillary Clinton is actually the more dangerous candidate. Her policies and her, as a reflection of the Obama administration and an escalation of Obama's policies, are the realization of much of what Trump says and, in some ways, when it comes to foreign policy, the opposite of what Trump is saying. So I think we need to look at this very concretely, this moment very carefully, and begin to create a political alternative that that can articulate and sort of communicate to the masses what this really all means. And I think a united front against Trump, or a popular front, or however one wants to frame it, is a mistake in that it misses that point. It misses a lot of points.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a cartoon version of a united front, and with Trump as Hitler and Hillary Clinton as Hindenburg. So looking broader than just their focus on Trump, at the common sense of the electorate, to use Gramsci's definition of it, the ideological framework for, the ideological cesspool, essentially, that is the basis of political discourse in the United States. Trump is introducing these new concepts into it and, reifying them, essentially, by this is what the guy I identify with, whoever among his constituency, disaffected workers that are not racialized, to the worst racists, working class, many of them, also dispossessed middle class, many of them. Suddenly the idea of let's forget this interventionist foreign policy, this imperialist military construct around the world, and shut it down, let people defend themselves, and let's start doing business. That is now into the discourse. At the same time, the word socialism and concepts that are at least Keynesian are allowed back in the political discourse, where they've been barred for 40 years.
Right. Yep. And I think, this moment should really embolden us as, principal leftists to take the discourse even further, because I think what both Trump and Sanders reflect is the popular, discontent and disaffection of much of the working class. And, it really does show the divisions in the working class as well, because I think there's a large section of working class liberals who are for Sanders, but then a large section of working class sort of, you know, right wing supporters supporting Trump. But at the same time, if we look at what Trump and Sanders are saying, it's almost different versions of very similar things, whether it's on economic issues like trade, Wall Street, or both Trump and Sanders saying that the United States shouldn't be the policeman of the world. Both of them have said that, have said that very specifically. So I think, you know, when it comes to Trump, when it comes to Sanders, and when it comes to this whole electoral corporate duopoly in the United States, what really has to be focused on is, in this moment where people are being once again sucked back into this machine and really putting a lot of their hopes for the future and for the present in it, we have to be really steadfast and intensify the struggle to understand exactly, you know, what should we expect from Washington? What should we expect from the imperialist state? And how do we really press on? I think that's what I tried to do in my article, the actual material conditions that we face right now and what we faced over the last year with the Obama administration, and how that really has been just a realization of a lot of the so-called, lesser of two, the greater of two evils in the Republican Party, how a lot of Democratic Party policies have been really a mere realization of the so-called greater of two evils. So I think that should be a real focal point right now, and it shouldn't be seen as support or, you know, tacit or, you know, covert support for the Republican Party, because it has what really matters is, you know, what are people going through right now? What are working class people experiencing? And unless we can articulate an ideology that both reflects that and also pushes working class people into more radical and revolutionary action, then we're not really doing anything in this election period, and we're going to basically see what we've seen over the last 8 years just reproduced in a different form. And I think that's what the two-party corporate duopoly in the United States is all about.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of it along an x-axis, say from -5 to 5, with 0 being the political center, -5 the left, and 5 the right. So you're presented in the first election with a choice between 1 and 2. And so everyone must choose 1 to prevent 2. The next election, you're presented with 2 and 3. And then after that, 3 and 4. And they're up on like 11 now. You know, Clinton's maybe 10 compared to Jimmy Carter, okay? And, with that dynamic operating, you obviously have to develop a new strategy, or I would argue a strategy, because we haven't had one yet. Now, if you're looking, first of all, at possible eventualities of the primary process, on the one hand, if you have Clinton and Trump, or Clinton and Cruz, whatever, you have now between Clinton and Trump some actual differences in terms of foreign policy, at least. And then you have, of course, the horrible racism that it surrounds him, if it's not articulated directly by him. It's certainly louder than dog whistled by him. So, you know, that's in the United States, this is not a choice that you can make, because, of course, this is a country founded on racism, and it's the central struggle that we face all the time. On the other hand, you know, defeating racism in a pile of nuclear ash, which is where Hillary Clinton seems to be heading. This is the architect of the, and her people, but the architect from afar of the policy in Ukraine, for example, and certainly the destruction of Libya, the introduction of AFRICOM across the continent, you know, lots of really horrible imperialist and racist things, murderous policies. And then, of course, a comparison. Trump talks Islamophobia. Clinton, as you point out, kills Muslims. Trump talks, dog whistles racism in the United States. You know, Clinton and her husband, when he was president, but she had a big hand in lobbying for this stuff, sold mass incarceration of black people in the United States, legislated it. So, you know, there's not much of a choice on that one. And so we should be, of course, looking at third-party choices as the only choices under those circumstances. And so the task there becomes how to get third-party candidates out into the public discussion in a way that's going to be meaningful. There's that one. Then you have, let's say, Sanders and Trump. Now you suddenly have, for Sanders, who could not do this before, able to re-examine American foreign policy as well. When a socialist enters the game, and he's been using the economic as his primary talking point because that is the urgent problem in the United States as he perceives it, and it certainly is arguably that, it's certainly the one that's a common thought among the electorate and a common condition. You know, he can't say, let's be friends with Russia while saying he's a socialist, you know, all by himself. Or, you know, come on, do we need to know what they do to him after that? It could pull out the TV ads from the 50s, 60s, whatever. Yeah. But Trump is opening that space up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have Sanders and Trump, now perhaps you have the opportunity and particularly the obligation by those of us on the ground to push Sanders to out, you know, come to your senses on foreign policy, Trump.
Yeah.
So there's that. You have the possibility, of course, that Clinton and Cruz or Kasich are going to end up being the candidates, and both Sanders people in the Democratic Party and Trump's people in the Republican Party, and maybe Kasich's or Cruz's, depending on how that plays out, are going to be angry, more disaffected than they are, and completely renounce the political structures and be turning towards third parties. And again, somehow, it seems to me the task right now is how do we get the third-party candidates, what happens? First of all, I think there should be, and I'm trying to actually put this together now, every time that there's a debate like this Tuesday, there should be a third-party debate that involves Jill Stein, Monica Moorhead, Gloria LaRiva, Rocky Anderson, what's his name, the Constitution Party guy, you know, all of those people parsing maybe for half of the debate the subject matter of the Republican Party debate Tuesday, the other half the issues that nobody's talking about, and start getting that stuff out there so that as people become more disaffected, they've already been listening.
Right. Right. And I think that's a great point. There are opportunities abound, I think, in the 2016 elections because it really represents this post-Obama stupor that and hangover that we are now in that I don't think anyone could have predicted would produce such a politically rich debate and conversation that has occurred in this election cycle. And I think that in order for a third party candidate or, you know, just an alternative organization to be really considered in the United States, what has to happen is that the fissures and the divisions and the cracks in the two-party corporate duopoly have to be attacked on all fronts. And I think, you know, the left as a whole and the principal left on the ground has to be honest in this election cycle about what has just happened over the last 8 years. I think that is a really huge way, as Trump would say, huge way, into, you know, taking advantage of the opportunities presented by the cracks. So, you know, as you were saying, and we can do this with the Obama administration, as unpopular as it may be still, to do this, where, you know, Trump says, you know, all Mexicans are rapists and that he would get Mexico to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. The Obama administration has deported more immigrants than any president in U.S. history, Chicano immigrants.
Than all presidents in U.S. history, actually.
Than all presidents in U.S. history, and has you know, continued to escalate and increase the funding for militarizing the border. And if anyone has ever been to the U.S.-Mexican border, it becomes quite painfully obvious that there is a metaphorical wall along the U.S.-Mexican border in which military contractors as well as the U.S. government have fortified a deep and murderous and disastrous and dangerous scenario where, you know, hundreds of people die each year trying to cross it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.